Autumn in Arkansas flaunts only its absence. A broken promise, it's the worst of summers called by another name. Sullen September heat causes yellow jasmines and bell flowers to pant for mercy. The reek of their dying scent as loud as a scream. Buildings bulge with wet heat and children turned out of doors by well-meaning mothers wilt in their front yards or search for shade beneath pecan trees. Even language melts on the tongue. Sentences slur. Words gasp for breath in the mouth. Howdy takes days to say. Like death, the autumn heat is inescapable.
Good morning. This is Black Book Talk, and you are just listening to the voice of April Reynolds reading from her book, Knee Deep in Wonder. I'm Emma Jackson Ford, Bookwoman.
I'm Patricia Welch, North Portland Branch Library. Library Lady, I guess, is going to be my new mom.
Library Lady, I like that.
And our guest?
I'm April Reynolds, author of Knee Deep in Wonder.
Well, today we have a wonderful interview with April Reynolds, as you probably figured out. I want to know when you started on this book and how long it took, because it is totally wonderful. Please don't tell me you wrote this in 30 days.
Oh, I wish. Wouldn't that be lovely? I'm so jealous of those writers who can manage that. I started writing this probably my sophomore year of college. And it took me, it took me 7 years to write. The first 3 years I was writing it, obviously I was a full-time student. And then the next 3 years, I was working full-time. The next 2 years, I was working full-time. And then I sold the manuscript sort of unfinished, and then took another 2 years to finally complete it and revise it. So it took 7 years in all.
I read that the idea, or I guess the inspiration for this book, came from a long conversation with your father that took place over a year span?
Yeah, actually it was several conversations, and it probably, sort of off and on for a long time, for about 5-6 years.
Oh, 5 or 6 years.
Yeah, well, he had a lot to say, my daddy. He's a big blabbermouth. And basically what happened was is that I think this is in the winter of 94. My dad became really ill and fell into a coma. And the doctors were absolutely certain that he was going to die. And so we all sort of gathered around and to pay our last respects. And lo and behold, my dad woke up just full of piss and vinegar. He had been out for so long. And the first thing he wanted to talk to me about after, he got out of the hospital was about growing up in Arkansas and what it was like and his neighbors and his father and his mom. And I just found all the stories fascinating. And up until that point, actually, it's interesting. When I was a junior, senior in high school, I had a teacher come to me and say, April, I think you should write. You should be a writer. And I thought, that's interesting, but I have nothing to write about, so I don't think I'm going to be doing that. And I went off to college, and I came back after my freshman year, and she was so upset that I hadn't taken a writing class. And that summer and that winter, my dad became ill and came with me to about these stories, and I sort of for the first time felt like I had something to write about. I mean, it was interesting that it wasn't about myself, but it was about my family, and I'd never heard about these people. My father, up until that point, had not been a very communicative man. I mean, we were not the kind of family that sat down together and talked about our past, and this is where you grew up, and this is what it means to be Black in America, and so on and so forth. And, when he became better after he was sick that winter, it just all sort of poured out of him. And one of the really interesting stories that he told me was about my granddad, who had died trying to save a young boy from drowning. Okay. And apparently, my grandfather not only notoriously did not know how to swim, it was like the town's joke that my grandfather didn't know how to swim. But he had a morbid fear of the water. Just just could not stand more than a Tubbsworth. And so my dad and I just went round and round and around. Like, given all that, what in the devil was he thinking? Trying to save some kid. And apparently he didn't even know the kid. It was some out-of-towner that was coming to visit from Kansas City. And sort of basically, waddled off into the sort of deeper end of the creek. And my grandfather died in knee-deep water.
Did he save the child?
No.
Oh, great.
But your book mm-hmm. has a heroine.
Yes.
It's a woman who's the main character.
Yes.
So how did you move from the story of your grandfather saving a boy, trying to save a boy and drowning, to having a female heroine?
Well, you know, it's sort of interesting. I think that when I first, started writing it, I really felt like I wanted to protect my dad's identity.
Okay.
And I didn't want everyone to know that this was his story. And I changed my dad into a girl. I did, and a lot of who Helene is based on my dad. It's my dad in a wig.
tell us the overview of the story.
The overview, I mean, it's kind of complicated to all work out, but the long short of it is this woman, Helene Strickland, is 26 years old and decides that she's gotten to a point in her life where she's not married, she doesn't have children, she's not on a career path, she's sort of aimless in life, and she has decided that if she is able to sort of understand where she came from, why it is her familial circumstances are the way they are, she'll be able to get on with her life.
Well, yeah, I'd say she was confused. She went to Spelman and is a nurse's aide.
Exactly. She sort of instantly falls apart. And her aunt, who raised her, has recently died. And she decides this is a perfect excuse to go down and talk to her mother and wrangle out of this woman what exactly is going on with her family. And so we sort of follow her on that journey. And then meanwhile, back at the ranch, however, I wanted the reader to be privy to a familial past that Helene would never have. And so with every chapter, there's a back chapter that sort of is holding this historical past that Helene doesn't know. And I won't tell you because I don't want to give away the ending, but some interesting frustrations happen.
Yes.
Oh, every step of the way. But, I have to say, after reading about three chapters of this book, I did what I've been saying I'm going to do forever. I've been saying I'm going to start writing to people, sending cards or something. I sat down. I didn't write the letter, but I went to the store, bought all these cards, sent my mama this card. Not that I don't talk to her all the time. But I said, no, we need to write this down. I wrote some things to other people. And to me, this was, among other things, it was a story about the importance of mothers. I mean, these people had a mother hunger in them.
Yes.
They truly did. And it just seemed to inform their lives. And I said, this is just so important. People need to understand the importance of really how parents relate to their children. But, this was just so much a story of how people really need to have a mama.
Right.
If it's not if it's not a blood relationship, they really need to have somebody who fills that role for them in the way that they need to have it filled.
Yeah.
Oh, Helene's hunger just made me so sad. You expressed it so well, and I said, my gosh, anybody who has a mother, if they have a pretty good relationship with their mother, woof, you ought to be thankful. But I love the way you switch between, the present for Helene and the past. And this is quite the mystery. We've seen these mysteries. But I don't know. I was just impressed with that. But I did want to ask you something else. It's about the process. I seem to be hearing you say that this is your first novel.
This is my first novel.
This was your first major writing piece.
Yes, yes. And it was it was the first thing I've ever written.
This is what I was here. See, it's not like you've been secretly writing little books and stuff.
No.
This is your first time out Whoa, okay.
But we have
I just want to
remember,
be real clear.
Go she's on not then. A babe in the woods. She teaches literature at Sarah Lawrence.
Okay.
So she knows a bit about
that's
literature.
Right, thank you. And this went through like several major rewrites. I just stuck with the story.
But when you started it, you were in college. Now,
yes.
When you started, did you start it as a novel or you just started jotting something? I mean, was your intention at that time to write a novel that would be published or just to get this down?
No, it wasn't. You know, basically, it's really weird about my writing career. It's a series of me feeling compelled to fulfill obligations. I mean, I started writing because my teacher was so upset, and it so upset me that she was upset that I thought, okay. I'll write it. I'll write something.
And we then, like to inspire that.
Exactly. You know, like, I could not stand it that she was mad at me. And, you know, all of a sudden my father's giving me all these stories and I thought, this is
there
perfect.
It is.
I, you know,
it was meant.
Can write something that is interesting and she won't be mad at me anymore and it'll be great. And I sort of started writing it, not knowing where it was going to go, just wanted to finish it. And I sort of moseyed along through college and my dad sort of asked me at one point, so, you know, you keep talking to me about this stuff and you're writing it down. And I got real high that my father was so proud to tell me these stories. Oh, my goodness. He's like, I got the story for you, April. And I jotted it down. He's like, are you writing it down? I'm like, yes, I'm writing it down. And he'd be so happy. And I was so happy that he was happy. And then I graduated from college. And I remember this Melvin Bouquet, who is my mentor and was my college professor, took me out for drinks and said, April, I know you got a job, and I had a job. I was working at Forbes magazine, and I was so excited, ladies, to be working at Forbes magazine.
Yeah, we are too. We're happy for you.
There was nothing better than working for Forbes. I just thought, oh, I have made it.
And
it's
the pinnacle.
I was making $21,000 a year. And I called my dad, and he could not believe I was making that much money. He was like, oh, my God.
Were you living in New York?
I was living in New York.
But you didn't tell him the reality of $21,000
you know,
in New York.
At the time, I didn't know the reality. It was my first
even
year.
Better.
Yeah, it was even. I was just as pleased as he was.
That's great.
And I was like, I'm making $21,000. He's like, oh, my, you're rich. I'm like, I'm rich. And that's what happens when you're from the South. It does.
Young.
You just have no clue. And
how you can enjoy life.
You know, you're just perpetually happy. And my professor took me out and he said, I know you're really happy that you're working at Forbes. And I said, yes, I am. And he said, but, you know, I think that you could really do something with this story you've written. And April, you know, if you don't want to be a writer, I think that's great. I'll still be your friend. But if you want to finish this and if you want to make a real go of it, I will help you in every way I know how. And basically that's what, and I didn't want to let him down. I didn't want to say.
Teachers inspire that.
I've just been lucky to be, you know, surrounded by very good teachers.
Yes. That's how good girls syndrome. You don't want them to be mad at you. You want to make them happy. But sometimes it really pays off well.
It's true. And so I did. I sort of thought, okay, you know what? I said I was going to do it, so I'm going to do it. And I sort of sat down and made a real habit of talking to my dad like 6-7 times a day. And, you know, what's the price of a stamp in 1947? Help me out. What's going on? And we did it, you know, sort of, you know, tinkling with what he told me and putting it all together. And that's how it sort of came to be.
So do you tell him that he actually co-wrote? Oh, I love this. I wanted to check the dedication to my father. Yes. Because he was your co.
He was my co-author in so many ways.
I mean, he died before it was published, right?
He did.
But he knew it was coming.
Yes, he knew it was coming. And, in part because I had sold the manuscript before, you know,
a couple
3 years before he died. He was very, very pleased, very, very proud that so many people that he's never met would be interested.
wonderful.
And hearing this story about, you know, all these people in this little place in Lafayette County, which, you know, and that sort of blew his mind. And it blows mine in a way that people would be interested.
So this is really pretty autobiographical. I mean, I'm
yes and no. You know, it's funny. The more I wrote it, the more fictionalized it became.
Okay.
And the further removed, you know, suddenly I sort of kept the idea of chess being, I mean, what I found fascinating about it was my grandfather, for all intents and purposes, his life was dictated by women, by his wife, by his mistresses. He just, everything he was either trying to, like, have an affair with somebody else or trying to, like, make sure his own wife didn't find out. And, you know, his wife, Hallie, who's a real, who's my grandmother, was apparently, you know, it's interesting when you, to go back to your question about this whole mother-daughter relationship, one of the things that I took away with these conversations with my dad was, no one in my, none of my father nor my uncles or my aunts remember what my grandmother looked like. They just cannot recall her. And there's no pictures of her. And the only thing, and they, she died when they were very young.
Oh, okay.
She died of cancer, which was weird because they were really relieved. Because they thought, well, at least she didn't have tuberculosis. Because if you have tuberculosis, you die. But cancer, I don't know about it. Maybe you could get over it. And the only thing they remember about her is her hair, this abundance of hair, and that she was incredibly tall. And nevertheless, I mean, we spent probably about 9 months, my Uncle John, my aunt, my Uncle Arthur, my Aunt Betty, my Aunt Rose, my dad, searching. Can you remember what she looked like? Can you remember what she sounded like? I just remember her hair. Do you remember? I remember her hair, too. And it was, I mean, they absolutely adored this woman and remembered her as riveting and beautiful. And no one could tell me what she looked like. And I just found that such an incredible thing that, be, you know, that her sort of standing outside of their memory did not in one whit keep them from having absolute adoration for this woman who's a stranger. And the only title she has is mother. And I guess that's enough. And I wanted that sort of connection to be in the Liberty Queen Esther. That, you know, there's something about Queen Esther that in her soul, it's heartbreaking how much she loves her mother.
Yes.
And childish. And there's something beautiful about that. And that Helene wants that kind of love from her mother. And I thought that that, and that's how something very real became very fictionalized in Knee Deep.
Okay.
I liked it when Liberty, the part where you say something about when Liberty has met Sweets, and you said if she had had a mother, because Liberty's mother just abandoned her, you said if she had a mother, she would have seen him come shoot him away from the house.
That's right.
It's true.
It's so true. Our book club just read Their Eyes Were Watching God.
Oh, by Zora Neale Hurston.
And it reminded me of when, oh gosh. The first one that came, No. The very first man who caught Janie's eye.
Who was under the tree, who came along.
Right, and her grandmother just said, what's happening.
That's
we got to deal with this. Now, some people might not have liked the way she dealt with it, but she married her off fast because she saw what was happening and she was trying to protect her child.
Right.
And it's absolutely true in this story that, you know, a caring eye will see, a caring heart will intuit, you know. And it was, I thought it was very interesting that Liberty at that point said, you know what I missed and I don't want you to miss it. But Queen Esther, now, is she based on someone that your dad told you about? This, I mean, we want to talk about this wardrobe.
I don't know about you, but when I go into, like, houses of old black Southern women, they're all dressed that way. They have, like, you know, house coats on with their stockings rolled down.
Oh, no, I don't mean as an adult. Oh, I'm just saying.
As a child,
Liberty, her little girl clothes.
Yeah.
Tell me. I mean, because Liberty's not an intelligent woman.
No, she's not.
Opposite.
But you know, I think it's sort of interesting, which I hope, hopefully, I did well, is that without the right sort of familial love, that kind of love always becomes corrupting. And Liberty, as smart as she is, isn't above that. You know, that if you don't really, Liberty, for all of her smarts and all of her bravado, doesn't really know what it means, you know, never experienced parental love. No. And so she's not really quite sure how to express it. I mean, she ends up thinking, well, isn't that lovely, keeping something so precious and small?
And she, that's right. You did. You bring that out in the
kept.
Book. Right.
And she, you know, she's not kept herself. So how do you expect her to be able to
right.
keep what's hers? I mean, that's what is interesting. But for better or for worse, that's what her parents bequeathed to her. You know, love understood as something awry, as a corrupting
but
factor.
But also, now I recall there is a passage in the book that speaks to the fact. First of all, she says that no child that she loves will be sent away or left behind.
Exactly.
So it's the idea of keeping. And also, she is a person who really needs to have someone need her. She needs chess to need her. She needs.
Yes.
Okay. Just the descriptions were interesting. Oh, but yeah, as what you said about her as an adult, yes, we have all seen that in our families. It's like, what is going on
exactly.
here? And when you have the conversation, it's like, we don't even want to discuss that. So, okay, I've had that conversation myself. Okay, yeah.
Oh, boy.
Yes. Okay, that was very, a lot of that just rang so true.
Thank you.
Have you started another book?
Yes, I have. It's actually really different. I keep saying that. I hope that's true. It is taking place in the 80s, in 1986. And it's about, it's actually really funny. There's something about these characters that I don't think I'll ever be able to shake as long as I write. And so Morning, who's a minor character mm-hmm. in Knee Deep in Wonder, is now a major character in my next novel. And she's moved to New York, and she has children.
Oh, I was wondering what
she
happened
does.
To her. I was hoping she didn't just go into the woods.
In the woods and never heard of
eaten
again.
Eaten by the wolves or something. Okay.
And so, but it really, I mean, while she is one of the protagonists, it really follows this trajectory of this guy named Carl Harpon. And it's this sort of rise and political fall, who, oddly enough, in Morning's eyes, looks exactly like Chess.
Okay.
He's a dead ringer. So, yeah, that's what I'm working on next.
Now, H-U-B-B-A-R-D, is that Hubbard?
Yes.
Like I grew up with he was older than me, Hubbard Lee.
Uh-huh.
It's like that? Mm-hmm. Okay, that's what I thought you meant.
Oh, boy.
You know, before we close out, we want to read, we want to hear some more from the book. So could you find another passage that you like and share some more for our listeners?
Sure. Helene had spent her life swirling around the edges of Lafayette County, Queen Esther's County, taken to Dallas and then off to Heber Springs, Arkansas. Helene, by the age of 4, knew that all the front doors she walked through were never home. On Annie B, Uncle Ed and Helene stayed in places just long enough for Annie B to put maple trees in front yards, put basil, thyme, and rose bushes into the ground out of season, forever limp and wilting despite all her coaxing and cursing. The constant moving Ed put them through was marked by a trail of unfinished gardens Annie B left in her wake. Edward Taylor was an insurance salesman peddling home and health policies for $23 a year. Parceled and divided, payments were not even $2 a month. And for that, that child of yours can get to a hospital and get well if she ever gets sick, Uncle Ed would say over the dinner table, recounting what he told potential customers. And what they say? What they say, my baby girl? He asked, looking up at Helene from his plate. And at just 6 years old, she could mock a voice full of tired sass. Just give me the burial policy. Anything else, just the curse. Ada, Oklahoma, Ada, Oklahoma, Colby, Kansas, Monroe, Louisiana, places that were on the brink, as Uncle Ed said, close enough to prosperity that the townspeople could hold out their tongues and feel glasses of instant lemonade in lawn chairs coming their way. McCool, Mississippi, Best, Texas, Floyd, New Mexico. But despite new post offices and the opening of a second bank, there never was a chicken in every pot. Finally, by the age of 13, Helene realized that they weren't moving to towns on the edge of affluence. Ed was 30, 40 years late without knowing it, but to places that just had peaked. By the time Helene's family arrived on the four-lane interstate highway, the citizens of any given town had grown tired of hoping for better and were wary of anyone giving guarantees. So it was little wonder that Ed's insurance company never really got off the ground. His pledge that if anything went awry, there'd be money to cover it, seemed too good to be true. People's suspicious natures affected both Ed's business and Helene's young life. She was the child whose dresses had been bought from the sickness and death of others. And though her presence never stirred up any real hatred, no hair of hers was ever stolen and burnt in the flame of red candles. No one spat over his shoulder when she walked by. Helene was treated with careful negligence. Children avoided her because plucked and placed every 6 months, she gave off the heady smell of a dying flower, too bright and colorful to belong to the third grade. Children were wary of her too generous offers. "You can take all my sandwich I ate before I left the house." Loud laughter that should have been only a small snigger made them doubt their sharp wit. The rejection didn't really matter, since Helene was never in one place long enough to stop being a stranger. Instead, she moved, always just beyond Lafayette County. Helene's life took on the shape of a clock. Uncle Ed would set them down in the middle of the shorthand and then take them to the tip of the longhand, and Queen Esther was always the little knob at the center. At 18, Helene tried to leave the clock behind, flinging herself into Spelman College, where she learned to press her hair and talk on the phone with confidence about the late work of Jackson Pollock. Following graduation, she grabbed a bus to Seattle and hitched a ride to Palo Alto, trying hard not to stare at the white girls with short skirts and no panties who could talk and smoke at the same time, each floating word visible in the air. But Helene knew that she was still sitting somewhere on time's long hand, that the face of the clock in which she lived had no perimeter. Off and on, she would come back to Uncle Ed and Aunt Annie B., to Stamps, Arkansas, where they had retired. She trickled into their lives with letters from Little Rock, where she was a nurse's aide, then with a handful of phone calls from Jonesboro, and later Washington, D.C., until finally Helene in full landed in a heap at their doorstep, stiff from a four-hour bus ride. She readied a soft smile with just a bit of teeth to show grief, sympathy, and love all at the same time. But her smile failed when Uncle Ed opened the door. Annie B's death had chipped away at the traces of youth. A shock of gray now crowned her uncle's head. In the fall of 1976, Helene realized she was surrounded by the old, the dead, and the dying.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having
me. Thank you for coming and for reading.
Thank you.
This is a wonderful book. Knee Deep in Wonder by April Reynolds.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Well, I guess we'll say goodbye until next month. Goodbye.
Good books to you.